Today is Tuesday, January 16th. We're going to be working on more of the endocrine system today. Okay, so on page 6, we're going to look at the relationship between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. And this is going to set the stage for us in understanding how all these hormones operate together, especially those hormones that are under hormonal control. So this is a good time to go back and hit that term. We talked about the word hormonal stimuli in the last few minutes of class on Thursday. What does that mean we're doing in terms of control? Good. One hormone is what's causing the change. Good. So we've got one hormone coming from one part of the body that tells another part of the body to make or release hormones. So I kind of think of it like a passing the buck mechanism. So instead of just going and doing the job itself, the hormone tells another gland, I got a job for you to do. Go do this for me. So it's the lazy approach to getting the job done. But that's how it works. And that's actually negative feedback control at its finest. So thinking about this stuff with hypothalamus and pituitary, we want to think about hormonal control. We want to think about it in terms of negative feedback control. Okay? So I know in Bio210 you all probably talked about the hypothalamus, and you probably learned it was a really important part of the brain. Today we're going to focus on its role as home to the endocrine system. So you may have heard before that this pituitary gland down below is actually what we call the master endocrine gland, but I think that gives you the wrong sense. In fact, the hypothalamus is the one that controls that pituitary gland, okay? So, you know, I may have jokingly put into your course pack that the hypothalamus is kind of like the Wizard of Oz. And if you've ever seen the movie, the little man behind the curtain, he runs the show, right? Okay, so that's the hypothalamus. It is this piece of brain tissue that's kind of behind the curtain, so to speak, and it really runs the show here. Okay, so the hypothalamus, you'll notice, is connected very closely to the pituitary. There is an infundibulum, that is the stalk that connects those two together. And looking down below at the anterior and posterior pituitary, they're actually separated. They look like two different types of tissue there. In fact, do you know what type of tissue makes up your anterior pituitary? Gland tissue. Yeah, endocrine gland tissue. And kind of thinking back to Bio210, endocrine gland tissue is simply epithelial tissue in nature. And what do you know about epithelial tissue and its growth rate? Yeah, pretty fast, right. So that's just something we're going to tuck in the back of our minds, that this is endocrine gland tissue, and what that means is it's actually just fancy epithelial tissue in the anterior pituitary. Okay, and the posterior pituitary is not endocrine gland tissue. It's in fact made up of what? Nervous tissue. Good. Good. So posterior pituitary is made up of nervous tissue. So just kind of appreciating this for a moment, we know the endocrine tissue that is housed in the pituitary is specifically housed in the anterior portion. The posterior portion of your pituitary is actually made up of nervous tissue. Okay? Back when you, here, if you had a dollar, we could all quit and retire right now. If you had a dollar for every time I said back in Bio210, right? But when you studied Bio210 epithelial tissues, you probably heard the words absorption, secretion, diffusion, filtration all the time for epithelials, right? Okay, so when we're thinking about epithelial tissue, we're talking about secretion of hormones. And that is not a function we assign to the nervous tissue back here in the posterior side. So just appreciating what we already know, we know that that posterior pituitary is not making its own hormones. The hormones that are being made in the pituitary gland are only made on which side? Anterior. Yeah, so anterior has the ability to make those hormones. Okay, so when we started this conversation, I mentioned that this is a classic relationship here between hypothalamus and pituitary of hormonal control. So the hypothalamus exerts hormonal control over the anterior pituitary. meaning we're going to tell the anterior pituitary what we want it to make and when we want it to make it. So this is going to be one of those cases of hormones coming from the hypothalamus down through a blood network to your anterior pituitary, and the message for your pituitary is either increase production of hormones or decrease production of hormones. Okay, so the way we do that is by using releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. And where do they come from? Yeah, hypothalamus, good. Now, I just want to mention that you do not have to memorize the abbreviations for all these hormones. You may, in fact, get them all to stick as abbreviations, but two things that are worth knowing as abbreviations are the letters RH and IH. Anytime you see a suffix of RH, it means it's a releasing hormone. IH means it's an inhibiting hormone. Okay, and in fact, it's so important, I made a rule paper out of it. Okay, so this is a good flashcard to have. Releasing hormones are RH, inhibiting are IH. The ones we're discussing today are made by the hypothalamus, and they all target the anterior pituitary. Okay, so you're going to want to repeat this to yourself until you get it to stick, because this is a really important thing that will help you to not have to memorize a whole bunch of stuff. So when you see RH and IH as part of a name of a hormone, you say, ah, okay, there's my clue. RH says I'm made at the hypothalamus, and I am targeting the anterior pituitary. Okay, so that saves you a lot of grief in having to memorize about six different names of hormones. All right, so these are kind of like a gas pedal and a brake pedal. Which of these two hormones, releasing or inhibiting, do you think encourages production of hormones by your anterior pituitary?
Releasing.
Yeah, releasing. And what does that inhibiting hormone tell?
Stops
it. Good. So again, this is all negative feedback. This is a way to tweak the levels in the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So you've got like a gas pedal to encourage and a brake pedal to stop. Okay. So what I'd like to do is pause on page 6 and take you over to page 7 for just a moment. And I think probably the easiest way to work through this is to talk through the chart. Okay, so like I mentioned a minute ago, it's easier to just say, hey, I recognize RH and IH for what that is. RH and IH hormones come from the hypothalamus, and they all target the anterior pituitary. Now, if I keep that straight and I know that, then I don't have to memorize this list. That sounds like a pretty good deal, right? Okay, so if it makes you feel more comfortable to memorize the list, you're welcome to do that. The catch is here that these hormones all come from the hypothalamus, and all of these hormones are going to target that anterior pituitary with some message. Thankfully, the message is written in the front part of the hormone name. So let's just take these and work through them, and that's what we're going to do on page 7. And I've got a chart similar to it here on the board. We'll just work through this one. Okay, so it looks like on your chart on page 7, what do we have first? Growth hormone?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's do that one first. All right, so we know the hypothalamus makes growth hormone, releasing hormone, and growth hormone inhibiting hormone. And like I mentioned a minute ago, you guys don't have to memorize GHRH as the abbreviation. On the test, I will give you the words growth hormone, releasing hormone written out, and then in parentheses, I'll put GHRH. So if you've memorized the whole name or the abbreviation, you've got something to work with either way, okay? So which of these two, RH or IH, is going to tell the anterior pituitary to make more growth hormone?
RH,
yeah, the releasing, good. If you've got too much growth hormone in your bloodstream, a negative feedback loop kicks on, and what impact does that have on these two? Now we turn on IH, yeah, so we decrease the RH, and then we're going to bump up and increase the IH, and that will tweak us back into our range, good. Okay, so growth hormone is one that you were probably familiar with. We can go ahead and talk a little bit about growth hormone, just get you a little bit ahead here. Growth hormone, you probably have heard, is going to make you grow. I know that's why you came to class today, is to learn this exciting piece of knowledge, right? Okay, so what body cells have an ability to respond to growth hormone? All of them. Yeah. So the catch is, this is a protein-based hormone. So where's the receptor housed? Outside, yeah. So practically every cell in your body has a receptor on the outside membrane surface that is present for growth hormone. Okay, and I should mention again that growth hormone is made by your anterior pituitary. I can talk, it's like a Monday. Anterior pituitary in response to GHRH. So we normally see the growth occurring in our bones and our muscles and our livers. That's where we tend to see the most pronounced amount of growth. And if you need an excuse to get your kids to go to bed at night, maybe you don't have kids yet, but just tuck this nugget of information away for when you do. If you want your kids to grow, they got to sleep, right?
Right.
Okay. And as adults, if you're done growing, you still got to repair, and the repair process is accomplished by growth hormone. So sleeping is actually a good thing for us to help repair and grow our bodies. So those who work on a swing shift and, you know, you're up and down different times, days and nights, then think about how that influences the body's ability to grow and repair. So they've actually done blood measurements and they've sampled at night and they say, okay, hey, when you're asleep, this is when your growth hormone levels increase and your repair process is going to become maxed out. So interesting stuff there to know. Just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Good. Okay, anybody else? Okay. Just mimics what we've talked about. This is a pass-the-buck hormonal stimuli, okay? So we started off with the hypothalamus secreting growth hormone release hormone. That tells the anterior pituitary to make growth hormone. Growth hormone targets practically every body cell in your body. Almost every single cell has a receptor. And in response, those body cells grow larger in size. You know, this PowerPoint is in the D2L content area. This, in a way, could be an instant flashcard for you. You could, in fact, print these PowerPoint slides off, cut these out, and then you've got an instant set to walk around and use until test time. Alternately, you may want to take something like this screen and then just white out different parts like I did on the board. You know, take and put growth hormone, put a blank there, see if you can figure out what hormone is encouraged. Or down here at the bottom, what it causes your cells to do, put a line there. See if you can go back later on and figure out what the function is of that hormone. So this can be an instant flashcard for you in studying for test one. All right. Let's talk about some growth hormone issues. Just to kind of take you full circle, when you studied the cell cycle back in Bio 210, you probably talked about, you know, an M phase for mitosis. You probably talked about these G phases. These G phases were sometimes called gap or growth phases, but in reality, that's where growth hormone exerts its effects on the cell's growth. So we now can kind of come full circle and appreciate that that G period on interphase is when we were experiencing growth of that cell. I just wanted to take a brief moment and mention that there's three issues that can arise with growth hormone. I'm not sure if you've got enough room there. Probably in the white space of the bottom of the page, you might have some room to jot down some info. Let me give you a moment to jot down the issues surrounding gigantism, acromegaly, and pituitary dwarfism. Okay, so let's talk about these terms here. Hyper and hypo are two extremes. So if we've got hypersecretion, of course, that's excess hormone production, and hyposecretion is not enough hormone production. That's one thing to notice. Another thing to notice is the time of life when these disorders may affect a person. Notice that gigantism and pituitary dwarfism affect us during our childhood growing years. And so those tend to arise at that period, and if not corrected, then we tend to see the effects linger throughout the entire lifetime. By contrast, acromegaly, you'll notice, is an adulthood issue. You know, 10-year-olds don't have acromegaly, but if they do have excess growth hormone and they've experienced gigantism at 10 years old, then come 25 years old, then they may now have acromegaly. So acromegaly is something that affects us in the extremities as we get older. Anybody still need this slide? Y'all good? Okay. Just real quick tour here of disorders. Gigantism is excess growth that occurs while those epiphyseal plates are open. You know, around what age do we expect epiphyseal plates to close? Yeah, 18 to 21, yeah, we're starting to see permanent changes in those plates, so we don't expect to see gigantism beyond, say, around age 21, okay? We do see heights somewhere like upper 6 feet, 7 foot, and beyond. There have been stories through recorded history of people something like 14 feet in height, and yeah, that's incredible, right? In recent times, you know, the past, you know, 150 years or so, the tallest recorded person has been around 9 feet tall, which is still incredibly tall. Andre the Giant, you may have heard of him, had a big career as a wrestler and an actor. He had gigantism during his growing years. In the early 20s of his lifetime, his epiphyseal plates closed, and at that point he still had excess growth hormone coursing through his bloodstream. So then he developed something called acromegaly. So what particular body part should you look at for acromegaly? Yeah, look at the hands, look at the feet, look at the facial features. Those particular body parts have less tissue covering them, and you're going to see more dramatic changes when those body parts enlarge. I'm not going to know if my femur got bigger, right? Okay, but you're going to know if your fingers got bigger. So that's where we see the enlargement of the extremities. This lady was the tallest woman at around 7'8" until her death in 2008. You know, most of these people with gigantism, we think of giants as being tall and strong, but in fact, their bones and muscles are stretched long and thin, yeah. And a lot of them have heart diseases, breathing disorders, because their bodies are not built to accommodate 7 or 8 feet of height, so their hearts wear out and their lungs are not able to pump enough oxygen and circulate enough oxygen for their bodies. Yao Ming's an interesting case. He does not have acromegaly. He only had gigantism. So if you compare his facial features back to Andre the Giant in the previous picture, mm-hmm. I think you'll notice that Yao Ming does not have the enlarged facial features that this guy has. If you followed his basketball career, Yao Ming retired with joint injuries, no surprise. That is a classic issue with gigantism.
How old are
you? I think early 30s, yeah. Which I guess is not too bad for NBA basketball,
right.
But.
Yeah.
8'11", yeah. This guy was pushing 9 feet tall in 1940. He was wearing custom leg braces and touring with the circus. And unfortunately, we've always heard don't pop the blisters, they can become infected. Well, his did. And the infection spread quickly, and within 2 weeks, he was dead from an infection. In 1940, we really weren't, you know, we were getting up and running with antibiotics, but we weren't really there yet. So unfortunately, he was a little before his time. Nowadays, you know, we probably could have curbed his growth, and we could have probably cured his infection. So he was just at an unfortunate time period. This is his dad pictured next to him. Yeah. And if you go to Myrtle Beach, I haven't been recently, but they used to have a wax figure of him by the street at Ripley's, believe it or not. So if you don't have to pay to go in to see it, you can just walk up by it and see it down there at Main Myrtle Beach. So the interesting story behind this guy, Robert Wadlow, was that at age 22, he had not yet gone through puberty. Most kids at age 22 have gone through puberty, right? That's been there, done that. So what we know about puberty is that those testosterone hormones should have closed his epiphyseal plates and his upward growth should have stopped. Mm-hmm. But unfortunate for him, you know, by not going through puberty, he was still experiencing upward growth and would have unless we figured out what to do to stop it. You know, nowadays, what would you do with these hormones from the hypothalamus to stop his growth? Yeah, giving the inhibiting hormone, right. So nowadays we probably could find a way to fix or at least stop him from growing further. Just a picture of acromegaly of the hands there. And, you know, a lot of times people don't necessarily realize they're experiencing acromegaly. They may see pictures and may notice that they've looked different over a time period. There are also some changes that may occur back in the face, such as, you know, sleep apnea can occur when people have acromegaly. I don't want you to think that anybody and everybody with sleep apnea has this disorder, because you're going to be going home telling somebody, watch me while I sleep tonight, would you? But that's not, it's not a 100% indicator of this disorder, but nonetheless, if your facial bones start to grow back inside your head, sure, you may have trouble breathing when you sleep. So this change you can see here has been facial features and hands, classic things that we look for with acromegaly. Another acromegaly. Look at this poor woman. She doesn't even look like a female by the time her life has gone to that point down there. And on the other end of the spectrum, pituitary dwarfism is these two people right here. And they look like children mixed in with people with other forms of dwarfism. So with pituitary dwarfism, we specify pituitary as the problem because we're looking specifically at which hormone being deficient. Growth hormone, right. Yep, so growth hormone is the one that's deficient here. Now, if we can catch this disorder early enough in life and treat it, what would you treat it with to make these people grow? You maybe, yeah, you could do the releasing hormone or growth hormone, sure could. And of course, you don't want to continue treatment for on and on and on. Around what age might you start checking for epiphyseal plate closure?
18.
Yeah, so at least before 18 to 21. In fact, I've heard they start testing kids at 11, 12, 13 when they start hitting puberty. Yeah, so once they hit puberty, we want to start watching to see if those plates close. Okay. So that one is growth hormone. Do y'all have any questions for the relationship between it and your hypothalamus? Okay.
I have a question. So you think
you don't have to have, you can be completely normal height, and then say at age 30, you may start having acromegaly, maybe from a tumor on the pituitary gland.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. In fact, this woman here looks like she may not have been a giant, and so, yeah, maybe in her late 20s, early 30s, maybe they started noticing these changes. Yeah. We'll come back and do those. Okay. Looks like we're ready for the next one there, which is thyroxine. Okay, so let's go back to our flow chart again. We're going to work one more time from the hypothalamus down this whole control mechanism. So we're now going to talk about a hormone made by your hypothalamus with an RH ending. What does that tell us?
Releasing hormone.
Good. And all of our releasing hormones today target the
anterior
pituitary. Good. Now, the T here, of course, stands for thyroid or thyrotropic releasing hormone. But I think that's a really fantastic clue because ultimately that's where this message is going. So TRH, thyroid releasing hormone, tells the anterior pituitary to make a hormone called?
Thyroid stimulating.
Good. Yeah, TSH stands for thyroid stimulating hormone. Okay, so TSH is made in response to TRH. TSH is made and released by your anterior pituitary. What gland does your thyroid stimulating hormone target?
Thyroid
gland. Take this a step further. In response, your thyroid gland makes thyroxine. Thyroxine is called T4. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the thyroid gland. Okay, so let's repeat some of this. TRH, the releasing hormone, made by your hypothalamus and targets the what?
Anterior pituitary.
Good. Where is TSH made?
Anterior pituitary,
good. And what does it target?
The thyroid
gland. Does TRH target your thyroid gland?
No,
it has a middle step there.
TSH,
right, at the anterior pituitary, good. What I'm trying to help eliminate are missed questions on tests. Because, you know, you really got to think stepwise here. TRH does not target the thyroid gland. TSH does target the thyroid gland, okay? So only thing that TRH targets is the anterior pituitary, okay? Now, if you have levels of thyroxine that are running too high, maybe your metabolic rate is too fast or, you know, your body temperature is too high, we actually cut on a negative feedback loop that goes and shuts off all the way at the top, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we shut down TRH and we actually turn on an inhibiting hormone. We're not going to worry about the inhibitor here because most of our issues here are keeping metabolism running at a fast enough rate. And as we get older, of course, that rate tends to slow down. All right, let's see. Our next one there is CRH. And that prefix, that C, stands for corticotropic. And I should tell you that cortico makes me think of your adrenal cortex. Okay, so the next one there, corticotropic, C, stands for the adrenal cortex. All right, so corticotropic releasing hormone, or CRH for short, is produced by your hypothalamus. It will now target your anterior pituitary. This is a mouthful. Anterior pituitary now makes ACTH.
Stimulating.
That's it. Good. Adrenocorticotropic stimulating hormone. I tell you what, probably one of the best clues here is the C, right? Okay, so that stands for cortex of the adrenal gland. In fact, AC says adrenal cortex. Yeah. So the adrenal gland is kind of like an apple. You can peel layers, and the adrenal cortex is the outermost layer. Okay. So ACTH, you're right, is adrenocorticotropic stimulating hormone. What a mouthful. Mm-hmm. And that's going to tell the adrenal glands to make some hormones. All right, so if you've taken a sneak peek ahead, what are some of the hormones your adrenal cortex may make? Good. That's good. So aldosterone and cortisol, sex hormones, good. So we will come back to that one as well. We'll talk about the adrenal gland hormones when we get into the adrenals, probably on Tuesday of next week. Now, the old joke is that sex starts in the brain, and that is true because sex hormone production actually initiates with a hypothalamic hormone in the brain. So when puberty hits, and sex hormones start to increase in levels, that has to come from a releasing hormone in the brain. The hormone we're talking about is this one here. It's G with a little N, R-H, and that G-N stands for gonads. Good. Good. And that R-H is? Good. And the target of all releasing hormones for our today's discussion? Anterior pituitary. Good. And in fact, there are two made here by the anterior pituitary. They are FSH and
LH.
Got it, good. FSH stands for follicle stimulating hormone. It has functions in both males and females. LH stands for luteinizing hormone. It too has functions in both males and females. So you may have heard of these two hormones in discussion about female menstrual and ovarian cycles before, but in fact, both of these hormones regulate components of a male and a female's cycle of making sperm or eggs, and they're also both involved in making testosterone in males and estrogen in females. So we'll certainly revisit those a little later on. Okay, and so the last of our hypothalamic hormones is PRH and PIH. Again, that RH and IH is just a reminder that we're working with hormones coming from the hypothalamus. And the P this time stands for prolactin. And prolactin's an easy one to keep straight. What does pro tell us?
First.
Or before or in favor of? And what about lactation? Milk, yeah. Good, so prolactin means that we're in favor of milk production. This should be something for moms that are breastfeeding, right? Okay, so prolactin releasing hormone is PRH, and prolactin inhibiting hormone is PIH. And we'll just shorten up prolactin and call it PRL for short. All right, so you'll notice that in this situation, we've got prolactin-releasing hormone coming from the hypothalamus. tells the anterior pituitary to release prolactin. In response, where does prolactin go to carry out the message?
Mammary glands.
Yeah, mammary glands. Okay, and of course, if prolactin goes to the mammary glands, prolactin tells the mammary glands to make
milk.
You got it. So who should be making milk? Mama's, right? Okay, not daddy's. Okay. If you know daddy's making milk, then there's
trouble,
yes. Yeah. In fact, where could it be? Pituitary? Maybe hypothalamus, but your best bet is pituitary. Do you know why? What type of tissue is it made up of? Epithelial tissue. And what do you know about its growth rate?
Fast.
Yeah. So the faster the growth rate, the more time there is for accidents and tumors to occur. So if you've got tumors, you know, that hypersecrete these hormones, you know, one likely place to point the finger is that anterior pituitary. I've taught here at Tech since 1999, and you know, usually we talk about everything, and I've had two people over the course of my time teaching here tell me that they've had an anterior pituitary tumor. So, you know, obviously they're not that common. Thankfully, they're not that common. And when they do surgery to remove the anterior pituitary, the going rate right now is to go like up under your upper lip, break a bone behind your nose, go into your brain very carefully because the pituitary sits between your optic nerves, snip out the pituitary gland, and then come back out with it. Mm-hmm. And they tell you when they do the surgery that this may not be a permanent fix because it's epithelial tissue and it may do what? It may grow back. So if you are one of the people that had an anterior pituitary tumor removed, then let's look at all the places where you may see an impact. So bones, muscles, body parts may not grow and repair as they should. Let's see, what about your metabolic rate? What influence might you have if there's no TSH? Slower metabolic rate, gain weight, exactly. Yeah, we haven't talked about these hormones yet, aldosterone and cortisol, but we'll talk about how that influences those. We may see issues for a female with, say, a menstrual or an ovarian cycle. And we may also see issues controlling milk production. So there's far-reaching effects for people that do have pituitary gland tumors and have to have those removed. A male who has milk production, we look at the pituitary gland, or we can look at something like breast cancer, which could also cause it. Yep. For the rest of us who are not currently breastfeeding, PRH is not your controlling hormone. In fact, this is a case where the inhibitor is in control. So PIH is the one that turns off prolactin. Okay, so if PIH shuts down prolactin, do your mammary glands get a message?
Yeah.
What message do they get? Or do they ever get a message? They don't get a message, yeah. So, yeah, if you shut off prolactin using PIH, then there's no message to be sent to those mammary glands. This is the toughest part of this chapter. Okay, so if you want to take a picture of this, if you want to spend a moment jotting it down, you guys do have it on page 7. I think this is probably the toughest speed bump to overcome. If you can get this straight, I think you're smooth sailing for the rest of the chapter. So what I'd like to do now is take you back to the bottom of page 6 and talk to you about the posterior pituitary for just a moment. Thank you. Okay, actually, it's right dead center of page 6. You'll notice number 2 in the very center of that page says the hypothalamus makes two hormones that are released from the posterior pituitary. That's where I'm at right now. And then once we read that sentence, I'm going to flip you over to page 8, okay, and then continue that thought. So what are the two hormones that your hypothalamus makes for your posterior? That's it. Good. Oxytocin, antidiuretic hormone. Good. Let me emphasize here, the posterior pituitary is made up of what type of tissue?
Nervous tissue.
Good. Does the posterior pituitary make any of its own hormones?
No.
So it only receives hormones made by your hypothalamus for storage, and then it releases those hormones into the bloodstream. So in this fancy picture, you can see those long axons coming from your hypothalamus. These little tiny bud-like endings are the axon terminals, and when stimulated, the axon terminals release vesicles full of neurotransmitter. Well, once they hop in the bloodstream, we're not going to call them neurotransmitter anymore. We should call them hormones. Yeah. So once that chemical gets in the bloodstream from these little axon terminals sitting right there, we're not going to call them neurotransmitters. We're now going to call them hormones since they're riding in the bloodstream. Okay. So the catch is, the posterior pituitary is a storage sac, you might say. It is simply a place where we store those two, oxytocin and ADH, until we're ready to release them. This now is a great example of neural stimulation. What does that mean we control these hormones by? Nerves, yeah. So this is a great example of neural stimulation. We're going to tell those two hormones, oxytocin and ADH, to be released thanks to nerve stimulation. Okay. So let's take oxytocin first. I've got the details for you over on page 8 near the top of the page, that little chart we're going to look at. Okay, so top of page 8, we're going to look at that chart for oxytocin. I know you guys have probably heard of this one before. It's a common female hormone. It makes the uterus of a female contract, as well as her mammary glands do something called a milk reflex or a milk letdown. Okay, so oxytocin is important for causing birth to take place in moms that are going through labor, and it also initiates the milk letdown reflex every time a mom plans to breastfeed. So here's an interesting relationship. In order for a mom to breastfeed her baby, oxytocin has to perform what's called the letdown. It's a reflex that begins the flow of milk in the breast mammary glands. Now, once the letdown reflex starts, then we have another hormone that maintains milk production during that particular breastfeeding event. What hormone is that? Prolactin, yeah, good. So what would you describe as the relationship between oxytocin, which starts the reflex of milk production, and prolactin that maintains it? They're synergist, good. Could you describe them in another way as well?
Positive feedback,
good. And one more way to describe them, one has to be present for the other to do its job.
Permissive.
Yeah, good. So you got three good things to think about there. Oxytocin gives permission for prolactin to do its job. They do work as synergists to bring about the response of breast milk production. So they're permissive, they're synergists. Yeah, and that's a great example of positive feedback. So as long as a baby suckles from the nipple of a mother's breast, that sends nerve impulses to her brain. Continue to produce what? Oxytocin
And of course, prolactin goes down the other route there. So as long as there's suckling going on, then oxytocin is maintained by the brain. Once the baby no longer suckles, then that positive feedback loop just stops, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so no more milk production then will occur because we stop this loop of hormone control. So really nice example of positive feedback control. So we don't really know any function in males. They do say that this is a very potent brain neurotransmitter. So interesting stuff about oxytocin. It makes you feel good. They say it's the love, trust, bond hormone, which may be the reason that after women give birth and they feel just awful, that you know they have this love for an infant or they want to nourish and cuddle this infant. Otherwise, why would anybody want to go through labor and then pick up and love a baby? You know, just doesn't make sense to go through that kind of physical effort and exertion. So interesting stuff about oxytocin. They do sell a nasal spray, but unfortunately, it does not cross the blood-brain barrier. So sniff away. It seems to have little influence on getting into your brain. So it'd be great if they could get that to work, because we could pipe that into airports and everywhere else. People have the rage issues, and
yeah.
Everybody would feel like, can I give you a hug today? Okay, so that's oxytocin. You may have heard of it as Pitocin. That is its synthetic form used in hospitals. Same influence, of course, over the uterus and the mammary glands. Let's see, the other important one for the posterior pituitary is this one. It's called antidiuretic hormone, or ADH for short. This is one where I think you'll end up knowing the abbreviation anyway. This is basically a course about ADH and its buddy aldosterone. So we will talk about it over and over throughout Bio 211. So I'm just curious, do you have an idea of how much you drink per day? Fluids. Okay. And do you have an idea of how much you urinate per day? Do you go to the bathroom maybe 6 times per day?
Yeah.
Okay. Probably about 6 times. Okay. And is the amount of times that you go to the bathroom and pee relative to how much you've drunk that day?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So what antidiuretic hormone is doing is it's saving you trips to the bathroom. It is anti, which is what?
Against
diuresis. Which is a fancy word for
urination.
Urine formation, right. And if you didn't have antidiuretic hormone, guess how many times per day you'd probably go into the bathroom?
A lot,
yeah. And so this would be a great way to get dehydrated if you did not have antidiuretic hormone. So the benefit of ADH is to prevent urine formation. This particular hormone, you'll notice, promotes water retention and prevents dehydration. So what you drink, you know, is hopefully going to be kept by your body, and only minimal amounts are going to be lost in your urine. So one way we can do this is to vasoconstrict. If you happen to be losing too many fluids, ADH will cause vasoconstriction. So what do you think that term tells us? Good. Squeeze and shrink those vessels, right? And if your vessels are uptight, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up too. Good. So that's why we alternately call this particular one vasopressin, because it also plays a role in increasing blood pressure. So let me give you an example. If you had, say, a bag of salty potato chips and nothing else to drink or eat with it, give it about 30 minutes and you're like, give me anything to drink, right? Okay, so even if it's something nasty, just give it to me to drink. That's what ADH is going to help us prevent, is the dehydration that comes when your blood becomes too salty, okay? So back when you studied osmosis in Bio 210, you always learn that water follows... Gotcha. Okay, so if you're too salty, then you're going to make less urine because the water that should have been lost in your urine gets reclaimed back into your bloodstream. Yeah. So how does that help you if you're too salty?
Makes
getting saltier.
Keeps you from getting saltier, exactly. Yeah. And if you have that bag of chips and nothing to drink, a couple hours later, do you pee?
No.
Now, you've kept all the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Try to keep you hydrated, exactly. So when you're salty, you know it because you get thirsty. And that's going to help to maintain water and salt balance in your body, and so does ADH. ADH says, hey, if you're too salty and you're not drinking enough, then I'll just keep the water from your pee. Ew. Okay? But that's what it does. It says, you're not peeing this out. We're going to keep this fluid. Yeah. Okay. So a couple of take-home messages about anti-diuretic hormone. It prevents dehydration. It makes you reabsorb water. And what does it do to your blood pressure?
Increases
it. Good. Yeah.
So is that why, like, when you typically have like a meal high in sodium, like your hands and fingers tend to swell?
Partly. Yeah. And give it a day or two, and that sorts itself out.
Right.
Because of aldosterone, but that's not necessarily this one entirely, or if it's got a butt. Yeah. So they tag team that approach. So, you know, we don't give ADH the credit that it deserves. You know, if you do not have enough anti-diuretic hormone, then you could lose something like 20 gallons of fluid in like a day's time on an extreme day. Most of us only lose about a gallon or two of urine per day just through urination. So, you know, you would be just going to the bathroom constantly if ADH was not keeping that water in your bloodstream. You'd be at a constant risk for dehydration as well. So, I do want to mention that there are a couple of issues with this particular hormone. One is alcohol's influence over it, and the other issue is a diabetes form called insipidus. So we'll talk about those two now. Okay, so let's hit alcohol first. We know that when people have alcohol in their system, what happens to urine output?
Increases,
right. So we know that people pee when they drink. But now we know the why, and that is because that alcohol suppresses ADH from where? Where's ADH released from? Yeah, posterior. Okay, so if you happen to have alcohol in your system, then ADH is not released from the posterior pituitary. I'm being very careful not to say made at the posterior pituitary, because where is ADH actually made?
Hypothalamus.
Yeah, hypothalamus. So I'm being very careful not to mix those words up. So alcohol suppresses ADH release from the posterior pituitary. If you have little or no ADH, what happens to the urine traveling through your kidneys? Flush it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So your urine output will increase. And what color will the urine be when alcohol is present in your system? Light yellow, yeah. So you're just flushing fluids through like crazy. The fluids will be light yellow in color. And what does that put you at risk for?
Dehydration,
exactly. So unfortunately, people that drink alcohol and don't rehydrate with anything may have, you know, cottony mouth the next morning. They may have a dehydration headache that comes as a hangover. And so if you want to be the uncool one at the party, then hydrate with something that's not sugary or caffeinated while you drink. Your alcoholic buzz won't be as great, but you won't have the dehydration effects the next morning. So you heard of nurses hooking themselves up to IV bags, right?
Yep.
So nurses, if they get dehydrated, just go to work, hook up to an IV bag, they resalinate, get that stuff back in their system. So that's what alcohol does, is all the negative effects that we tend to see are dehydration driven. Okay, so diabetes insipidus works, let's go back to that screen, the same way. Diabetes insipidus is like alcohol, but in this case, we have a disorder that does not produce enough ADH at the hypothalamus. And then, of course, that in turn releases very little from the posterior pituitary. So So notice the signs and symptoms here of this disorder. What is polyuria?
Increased urination.
Yeah, increased urination. Why does a person with this form of diabetes have that problem?
Lack of the
ADH, right. So the kidneys, instead of retaining water, release it. Yeah, it's like open up the water faucet and just let it flush on through, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then that in turn causes extreme thirst. Yep, polydipsia.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically just pouring water in one end and letting it run back out the other end.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think they do for a person who has this form of diabetes? Let's see, this alternate name is vasopressin. That's the drug they take. So what that drug does is it makes their kidneys retain water and has what influence on their blood pressure?
Increases
it, yeah.
Say that again.
Maybe not, because it may have been so low that this may bring it back to normal. Hey, what were you saying?
I was saying the same thing.
Yeah, hopefully, I mean, if this was so low, that would bring it to normal. Yeah. Okay, so let me emphasize here that there are more than one type of diabetes. There's actually something called diabetes insipidus and diabetes mellitus. This particular form is not the sugar diabetes. It's not the insulin one. It has nothing to do with the pancreas. So when people say diabetes, most of the time they mean mellitus, the one with the sugar issue. So I did want to mention there is no issue here with high blood sugar. This patient has no pancreatic problems. I mean, they could, but this particular issue is just simply an ADH issue. Now, to diagnose this, we'd probably do a brain scan. And what part of the brain would we be looking at? Hypothalamus and pituitary. Yeah, posterior is right. Good. Okay. All right, so that does it. That takes you down to that, through that chart on page 8. How about questions so far? How do you feel so far with the content today? Any place that I can go back and clarify before we keep on trucking? And let your brain fall out for just a minute. Okay, so what I'd like to do is see how far we can go on page 9. Okay, so we're looking now at, go ahead. Corticotropin for adrenal cortex. Any other questions? Iris?
Just to clarify, you said that the anterior has the glands kind of tissue?
Yeah. Glandular tissue or epithelial or endocrine tissue, that's right.
Okay, so and then the posterior is nervous.
Nervous, that's right. Okay, so thyroid gland is page 9. You'll notice that it sits around the trachea. Everybody's got an Adam's apple. It's called thyroid cartilage. It's a little knotty piece there on your trachea. And if you feel right below that thyroid cartilage, a little fleshy bow-tied shaped gland is your thyroid gland. And it should only wrap the front and the sides like a bow tie. It should not wrap all the way around your trachea. And so, of course, that means it's not on the back side where your trachea backs up to your esophagus. Even though it does not wrap you all the way around on the trachea, it can still constrict around your trachea and cause difficulty breathing if it begins to enlarge. Now imagine if it was a bow tie that you could snap it off and look at the back side of it. On the back side of your thyroid gland, you may also see around 4 to 8 little dots and those would be your parathyroid glands. When people have their thyroid removed, you know, maybe they have a cancer or, you know, another issue, they try really hard not to take out those parathyroid glands as well, because the parathyroids regulate blood calcium levels. Mm-hmm. So I just want to kind of introduce these two together since they're very closely related in terms of their location. Okay, so inside the thyroid gland, there's a couple of blanks for you all there on the worksheet to fill in. Follicle cells make thyroxine, or you can simply put thyroid hormone. Okay, so follicle cells make thyroxine, or you can simply put thyroid hormone. And then it says next, parafollicle cells make blank. Got any ideas for that one?
Calcitonin.
Calcitonin, good. Okay. So what I'm drawing is what's over here in the picture. There are like these spaces inside the thyroid gland called colloid. And the colloid is actually a jelly-like substance that stores thyroid hormone in your thyroid gland for about 30 days. Now, the cells that surround that colloid stuff are called follicle cells. And they specifically make thyroxine, which we're going to call T4, and triiodothyronine. Who comes up with these names? And what are we going to call triiodothyronine?
T3.
Good. And together, these two are called thyroid hormones, and they'll sometimes just call them the TH, meaning thyroid hormones. Okay, so I know there's a lot of confusion because there's three different names here that are working around the same thing. Okay, so let me repeat. We've got follicle cells, and those follicle cells are going to make two kinds of thyroid hormones, one called thyroxine, or T4, and another one called triiodothyronine, and that one is called T3. So if we don't want to call them by their specific names, it's like saying the Smith family. You know, if we don't want to talk about specific members, we can just call them the thyroid hormones. Okay? So nonetheless, these hormones are made by the follicle cells, and they can be stored here in the colloid. It's kind of like a jelly-like substance inside your thyroid gland. Yep, and they store it.
So does the colloid have T3 or T4?
Mostly it's T4 that's stored there in that colloid.
But when they pull it from the colloid, is that when it takes it with T3?
When it gets to the cells, when it is escorted to your cells and pushed into a cell, that's when it drops down and makes a T3. It drops off an iodine atom. But you can actually make some T3 and release it from the thyroid gland. But the majority, like 80% of what is released, is T4. Okay, so what I've got here are some other cells. These other cells are not necessarily the follicle cells. They're what we call parafollicle cells, and they release a totally different kind of hormone, and that is called calcitonin. Okay, so those are not the ones that surround the colloid. We don't store the calcitonin. Thank you. They don't store. It's just made on demand. So we're going to talk first about T4 and T3, and then we'll come back probably next class period and talk about calcitonin. I should mention that T4 and T3 are two thyroid hormones. T4 is thyroxine, and T4 has, guess what, 4 iodine atoms. T3 is triiodothyronine, and guess what, it has
3.
You got it, iodine atoms. Okay, so they differ by an iodine atom. I should also tell you that the most common hormone that's released from your thyroid follicle cells is T4. And there's a small amount of T3 that's made and put into circulation. Most often what we see, though, is T4 is converted down to T3 by simply losing an iodine atom when we get to our target cells. And I should also remind you that we talked about thyroxine in class last Thursday. This particular hormone is a protein, but it doesn't follow the rules. It does not do a secondary messenger system. How does it talk to its target cells? Direct gene, yeah. So it acts as a steroid would. It simply goes into the cell through the plasma membrane, and there, in the process of coming in, it drops off and loses an iodine atom. Now, I should also tell you that because thyroxine is our most common of the two hormones, and it is being circulated throughout our bloodstream, that it takes an escort service to carry it to its destination. And the escort is what we call a transport protein called thyroglobulin, and thyroglobulin is actually going to help move it out to those cells. All right, so unfortunately, thyroglobulin may not get all of its T4 to its destination, so they will sometimes measure bound T4 versus free T4, just to see how much of it's actually getting out there to your cells. Okay, so how about questions so far? Okay, so we look at thyroxine, or T3 and T4 together, as being our major metabolic hormones. These hormones together run the metabolism in your body, and they also promote the proper development of your body. So I do want to mention that because I'm trying to avoid saying the word growth, because there's already one for that, right? Okay, so we're not talking about growing your body, we're talking about the development of your body. So during what period of your life do you think this hormone is very important? Childhood, yeah. So we do see very important need for thyroid as you develop. I'm avoiding growing, because growth hormone is going to do that for us. But if you think about the development of your body, that's where thyroxine comes into play. And then throughout your entire lifetime, it regulates metabolism. I'd like to go back. Go ahead. It does lose an iodine. Yeah. That's the most common thing we see, even though you can have T3 being moved throughout the bloodstream, but most of what we see is T4 transported, lose an iodine, and then go into the cell as T3. This is probably worth hearing again, so why don't we start on Thursday with this stuff one more time, and then we'll work on thyroid, parathyroid, and adrenals come Thursday. So that's what you want to look head for come Thursday.